Welcome to The Sound of Economics. I'm Giuseppe Porcaro.
I'm Guntram Wolf.
I'm Maria de Mergis.
And I'm Andre Sapir.
And today we are going to do a special episode as the year 2021 is coming to an end. We are going to review this special year in economic policy and beyond and look at what we should watch out on this space for the year to come. I feel quite a déjà vu to speak to the three of you now about another year which is marked by the pandemic and by the uncertainty related to it, as Omicron is unleashed around, traveling is restricted again, and national measures have been tightened for this season. So, to start with, I mean, obviously, the pandemics and the vaccination and everything that has been related to the health policy around COVID-19 has taken a big space on the year, from the global race to vaccinate to the European story about the rollout of the vaccination campaign to the debate that there is now on COVID-19 passport, booster jabs and worldwide vaccine inequity as we face the new variants of the virus. So I would like to ask you to kick off our conversation exactly on this and also look a little bit over the course of the year, what we have been seeing and what is to come. Guntram, perhaps you would like to start?
Yeah, very quick. First of all, COVID is marking us. It has marked all of us. It has marked us as individuals, as societies, as families. And it, of course, leaves a big trace on our economy. And I think the beginning of the year, the European debate was very much marked by the worry of slow vaccine delivery, which the EU then caught up on. So the vaccines were delivered, but there was a moment where we as Europeans were lagging behind the US and the UK. And proudly, I have to say, though, Europe continued to export vaccines and, of course, also to be a leader in the global health response. And I want to emphasize that because global health experts and public policy experts understood very soon that no one is safe until everyone is safe. So the work on the global health response was really a priority for the EU, for many advanced economies. And was also priority for our institute because we did participate in a global task force trying to formulate recommendations for the global health response. Unfortunately, the reality looks much less nice than what we recommend. There's huge vaccine inequality. The mutations can continue to be with us because the vaccination rates globally are still very low. So the world is really not delivering on this actually very cheap global public good. And so I think one of the priorities going forward certainly needs to be to accelerate global vaccine rollout to ensure that the funding is available for pandemic prevention, preparedness and response, and really to get our global health response in action, because it feels like we are not yet through this pandemic. We might perhaps even just have reached the first third or the first half.
That's not a rosy outlook for the year to come, definitely, Guntram. It's not a matter of having the crystal ball, of course, but definitely we are still in the middle of it, one third or half of it, we don't know yet. Maria and Andre, is the macro story that Guntram is telling basically a success story in Europe, less a successful story at the global level? What else would we say? For example, zoom in within Europe itself, that the European situation is not as even as we might see. In Western Europe, we have very high vaccination rates. In Eastern Europe, we have a different situation. How all this is impacting on the outlook at local level? What is your take as well on what Guntram just said?
Yeah, for all the reasons that Guntram outlined, 2021 was the year where we are learning to live with the pandemic. I think that's basically how I see it. We have behavioral adjustments in our own everyday lives, in our professional lives. And it's all due to the fact that we haven't made enough progress to something that, well, it's new to us, but we have science that is telling us what to do, but we haven't advanced. Then we have to make additional changes in our lifestyles. It will have impact on the economy. It will have impact on many things. The good news is that with every wave of the pandemic that we are observing, the economic cost is smaller. We are actually observing that simply because the closures that we are, the restrictions that we are imposing are smaller. We're learning to deal with it and we are accepting the consequences. So therefore, the economic cost is also becoming smaller. But that doesn't mean that the uncertainty is resolved. And I think we need to come back to this issue as we talk about broader issues as well.
Andre, what's your take?
I'm maybe a bit more optimistic than my two colleagues and certainly Guntram. So first, I would say that at a personal level, 2021 was an easier year than 2020, and that the vaccine, at least for us in Europe where we live, has been a big factor in this. So yes, we like all citizens, we wondered a bit at the beginning of the year what exactly was the European game plan, as we observed that we were behind the United States, Israel, and the UK. It was a bit frustrating at the end of 2020, beginning of 2021. But then I think soon enough, we managed in Europe, or the authorities managed to accelerate vaccination. And as far as I'm concerned, in 2021, I was able to travel, even for professional reasons, to attend conferences a couple of times in the autumn, something I had not been able to do in 2020. So, you know, the outlook, at least also at the personal level, the outlook was certainly better in 2021 than in 2020. And I think that was reflected in the overall economy. So yes, there are still a lot of potential problems. One issue that I do see and that has not been mentioned is on the hospitals and on the health profession in general. So I think what we see is that thanks to the vaccination, as Maria said, each round has been less deadly health-wise and therefore less also negative economic-wise. And that's great. But it's clear also that this pandemic is lasting and that the health profession, and I'm talking of the health profession in general, not just the hospitals, but the health profession on the whole, in our country certainly, is getting tired, is getting exhausted of the situation. So there's a lot of demand on them. And if we remember that there was already some unhappiness of the health profession before the pandemic, it's adding up to something. So, you know, we have made progress on the vaccine. There are less cases, but at the same time, there is less ability on the part of the health profession to respond to each of those waves. And that is creating some friction. Therefore, discussion about obligation of vaccination and all of those kind of issues that, although I'm in favor of that personally, I see that it's also a divisive issue. So there are some political matters as this is a drawn-out process.
André, what you're just saying also reminds me, and I would like to ask the question to Guntram, the issue of preparedness, you know, like the issue that it's not just about this pandemic, but it's also about the overall state of health policy across the world at global level. And Guntram, you've been writing extensively about it this year. So maybe you would like to add something to what André just said.
I think I very much agree with André. The vaccines have helped enormously, and they will continue to be an important part of the response. But I think the reality has been that the vaccine rollout has been extremely uneven globally. And though the cost of vaccine purchases and distribution is actually limited, the world community, including the G7, but also the G20, but also the more United Nations-based organizations, have not been really able to yet organize a global vaccination campaign. So there's lots of practical issues why that's difficult. But there was also a lack of resources. And I have to say the lack of resources is somewhat disappointing, because it is really a pretty cheap global public good to provide. I mean, we are talking here of numbers of 10, 15 billion or something in that sort for this year. And then for next year, another 20 or 30 billion. So at the end of the day, less than 50 billion to get the world population vaccinated. And the potential gains are in trillions. So it really doesn't even make economic sense to save a penny in that. So in that sense, my hope for next year would be that world leaders will manage to not only fund a vaccination campaign and organize it, but put up more resources for a more permanent pandemic prevention, preparedness and response.
Absolutely. I think that we should join this call, and we did so. And in the show notes, we are going to link some of the analysis that we've done at Bruegel on the topic. Passing on to a related issue, we've managed the optimism that went through, I mean, especially Europe. I think that there was a booster of confidence when finally the vaccination campaign has been rolled out. This has been stated by the three of you. This definitely connects to the other big story, which was the recovery prospects. We've definitely been seeing both national measures, but at the European level, the Next Generation EU program and the national plans that were presented. So that will be a very interesting aspect to zoom in. Perhaps, I don't know if Maria would like to give us some general context within the frame of the macroeconomic outlook.
Yeah, you're right. The outlook in terms of growth perspective is actually looking good. I think, if I'm not mistaken, there's only very few countries now that have not currently returned to pre-pandemic levels of growth. I think that's the good news. And no doubt, most of it is due to the massive support that was given. So policy was put effectively to good use to try and keep the shock as short-lasted as possible. So that's the good news. And in terms of unemployment, also the numbers are looking up in ways that are very, optimistic, but also gives us a lot of confidence that policy was effective, because that's an important lesson to be learned. Policy did work. Now, with it comes also, however, something that was a little bit more unexpected, and that is the inflationary pressures. And I say unexpected because we haven't seen inflation for a very long time. There are very structural reasons why inflation has been low for such a long time. Those reasons have not gone away, and yet we are seeing inflationary pressures. There are two things that are contributing to this inflationary, if I may call it, headache. It's an inflation headache, at least for the euro area. The vast majority of inflationary pressures comes from either energy prices or from bottlenecks in supply chains. And the bottlenecks in supply chains have to do also with the pandemic and the ability to adjust at the speed of demand that we are observing. Now, these are things that are causing a real headache to the ECB in particular, because it's very difficult to know what to do about them. It is not easy for central banks to react to these types of shock, what we call in economic supply shocks. But the consumer feels it. It feels the pressure on its on their purse, and therefore will be demanding compensations for it, probably in the form of wage increases. If the consumer were to do that, we will have, unfortunately, spirals of price increases, what we call them the second round effects. That would really then require interference by central banks, by monetary authorities, in a very classical sense. That doesn't come without problems. In an era of very high indebtedness and financial fragmentation in Europe, if interest rates were to go up, it would cause other types of problems. So, the ECB is really caught between two positions that neither of them are very ideal. So that's the headache. But at least on the growth side, both current numbers and prospects are optimistic.
The question that you just mentioned, this headache that is at the monetary policy level, one of the issues over there is whether this is a temporary headache, or are we set to have a more longer term issue with inflation?
Yeah, the one thing I will say about camp permanent versus camp temporary is that it's become a little bit ideological. I really object to that. I mean, there's nothing ideological about inflation. There are measurements, there are numbers. We should find out what there is. We all have preferences, but the ECB has a mandate, and that is to preserve price stability. Look at the numbers and then decide what to do about this. When it becomes an ideological discussion, we all lose. In my view, the degrees of uncertainty are so enormous now. And if you look at the root cause of inflationary pressures, they're complex. And they're not necessarily just economic reasons, in particular on the energy price. So, to manage all that, you require of a clear mind and a very careful attention of what the numbers are telling us. Allow for the fact that there is uncertainty out there. And if there is huge uncertainties of the sorts that we are seeing, we need to be very careful how we position ourselves.
Andrea, I saw you shaking a little bit the head when Maria said the word ideological camp. So I'm very interested to hear from you.
That is true that I did make a sign of the head when Maria said there is nothing ideological. I would not quite agree with that, in the sense that inflation has distributional consequences. So if ideology is about that, is about having different views of the world based on certain prejudgment and prejudgment that are derived from one's own situation, then yes, I do think there are those in society that are more relaxed about inflation. Obviously, what kind of level of inflation? But, you know, if one is talking about 4%, some are more relaxed. And that would probably be younger people. And older people in societies who are usually bondholders, they're worried about inflation. So in that sense, ideology, there are divisions within society. And the central bank has to deal with that, knowing that within our society, across countries, there are different views. Yes, debt levels are high, not only public debts, private debts are very high. So creditors, debtors, they have different interests there. So, you know, if you owe money and there is high inflation, that's going to be much easier to deal with this. If you are, as I said, the debt holder, then certainly you would not like inflation to eat away at this. And I think in the end, it is somewhat a political issue, and central bankers are not politicians. And so I think it is indeed going to be, if this is getting a little bit out of hand, this will be a problem. Now, how will it get out of hand? I think, as Maria rightly said, it's the question of inflation's wage price spiral. And there, this is not so much a matter for the central bank. It's for governments. You know, governments have a role to play in knowing whether or not wage increases are going to happen. Are they going to resist wage increase? Knowing that if they don't, then the central bank will have to intervene. So politicians will not be able to say, this is just for the central bank, this is non-ideological, and this is, quote-unquote, an easy technical problem. This is going to be a highly political problem, even abstracting from the fact that in some countries like France, there's going to be election very soon. And this is going to add to this issue. So I would say that ideology and politics will be very much at the heart of this debate on inflation and on the potential spiral.
If I may add,
yeah.
In my view, it is not for central bank to have ideological positions. Central banks have got mandates, and they have to execute what their mandates are. Of course, all policies have got redistributional effects, all of them. There isn't one that doesn't have any distributional effect and political consequences. But if you give the central bank a task, you need to judge the central bank on that task. The rest is for the politicians to decide. And indeed, as you described, Andre, politicians have a role to play to guide this discussion. But the central bank needs to be judged exactly on the task that has been given.
So can we say that there are several headaches over there? There is not just the central bank who has an headache within the remit of his mandate. There are several headaches over there about the different mandates that the different actors have at play on this. And Gunther, maybe you want to add something on.
Just a few reactions. And I probably agree with Maria that it shouldn't be an ideology-driven decision. But I agree also with André that ideology matters in all of this. And ideology meaning not just ideology, but also, and I think André is right with this point, there's significant distributional issues at stake here. And I think the one dimension that I really want to add to the distributional dimension is the one that central bankers are actually worried about, because it could lead to second round effect. So not raising wages in consequence to 5 or 7% inflation means that you cut real wages, and you cut them very significantly. And that will not go down peacefully in our societies. So how to deal with this? I mean, just accept the higher inflation rate and accept the loss of real wage purchasing power? I don't think that can be the solution. And that's where I think the question of permanent versus transitory becomes absolutely central. If this is just sort of last quarter of this year, just 3-4 months of 5% inflation that we are seeing in the numbers, I think we can be relatively relaxed and the ECB will find its way out. But if, as increasingly many people believe, this lasts the entire year of 22, which I think is actually totally possible also because of the pandemic situation and the further supply chain disruptions we will get in China and elsewhere, I think the ECB has no choice but to react. I mean, it has to react because it has a mandate to control inflation and not a mandate to sort of control inflation 5 years down the road. So in that sense, I do think the time horizon matters hugely. And early next year, we will know pretty well, or much better than we do now, how quickly inflationary pressures recede. But if they don't quickly recede, I don't see how you can justify continuing to be on the accelerator as the ECB is. I mean, continuing to buy massive amounts of government bonds and, you know, keeping rates at negative. I don't see how you can justify that if inflation continues to be high during 22. So yes, the distributional issues are part of the story. But at the end of the day, of course, I agree with Maria that it has to be about the mandate. So it has to be about, do we achieve the inflation target? I think we're probably going to miss it. And the longer we miss it, the more the wage increases actually have to follow, because otherwise you have a big distributional issue. And as soon as the wage increases follow, you have more inflation and then you have a big problem.
We're definitely going to continue this conversation about inflation in 2022. Also, because this would require not just one podcast, but a series of analysis, which in any case, we are already on our website available for our listeners, but also a series of more conversations, seeing the lively debate that there is already just between the three of you, let's aside among different actors that are involved in this story. But you all mentioned part of the story of the inflation is linked to several things. We've mentioned energy prices, and we are going to touch on this in a second. But you also mentioned the global value chains disruptions, which brings to one of the other big topics of 2021, which is, of course, the global scene, global economics, and the intersection between global economics and geopolitics. We've seen the beginning of January starting the year with something that might have been just out of the wildest dystopian science fiction movie, which was the occupation of the US Congress by a horde of Trump supporters a few days before Biden's inauguration. But the year has been quite dense when it comes to global relations and intersection between political relations and economic relations. Andrei, what has been your take on this, and also to link it up with what we were saying before about the global value chain disruptions that we are witnessing?
Indeed, I think there are many dimensions in what you discuss. Some are more of the geoeconomics, like the global value chains. Some are more of the geopolitics, and some are obviously half and half. Now, on the global value chain, let's say globalization in general, I think there is, once again, as there was during the great financial crisis about 10 years ago, there was disruption of global value chains. And there has been a discussion already 10 years ago about whether we had reached peak globalization that had increased very, very rapidly. Some had described the period before the great financial crisis as a period of hyper-globalization. So some have questioned whether, you know, this had come to an end already at the time of the global financial crisis. And that discussion has been certainly reopened on the occasion of the pandemic and, you know, the disruption of the global value chain. And also because of what had happened at the start of the pandemic with the masks, with different, you know, medical equipment, then now with vaccination, then with semiconductors, different issue of indeed shortages. And that has also encouraged most of the big players in China, in Europe, in the United States, and elsewhere to take some policies in order to reshore or to shore, to bring to the domestic economy the production of some of those goods through subsidies, through various policies. So there is this whole discussion that is of a more economic, essentially, you know, how should we react to the uncertainty that Maria is talking about? And is uncertainty best served by reshoring, or is uncertainty in terms of production best served by having production being spread in many countries? So that's one aspect. Another aspect, which is not completely unrelated to the previous one, is, let's say, the US-China issue brought to the fore at the time of Trump and essentially continued during the Biden presidency. So certainly a big event of 2021 was Biden becoming president, and has been very much welcome in certainly in Europe. Certainly the dialogue between Europe and President Biden has been much better than the dialogue with President Trump. While at the same time, some of the policies that Trump was pursuing, in particular on some of the geopolitics issues like the US-China relation, have not been very, very different under President Biden. And that is raising some issues for Europe. Where do we stand in this tussle between the United States and Europe? Are we on the camp of democracy camp? Yes, obviously, together with the United States. And we repeat all the time that, you know, we have problems with some of the policies in China and respect to human rights, let's say to democracy. At the same time, China continues to be a very, very important economic partner. So that's partly geopolitics, but it's partly economics. And I think semiconductor, which is highly produced in Taiwan and, you know, with the issues of China, Taiwan, you know, all of this. Yes, we do see that the U.S. is reshoring production of semiconductors. We are also going to give subsidies in, you know, the foreign companies to come and produce in Europe. So many, many issues on geopolitics, many issues on that had already started before, but I think 2021 saw some heightening of those issues, and they will definitely continue in 2022.
Indeed, in all these, and I'm looking at Maria, if she wants to react on that, where is the role of Europe? You know, like we've been hearing a lot of talking about open strategic autonomy, for example, this concept of open strategic autonomy as a reaction to all the things that André just said.
You're adding yet another dimension to the already complicated things that André touched upon, but you're right, all of these things can link together. I just wanted perhaps to pick on one thing and then link it to all the things that André said and then link it, if you like, to strategic autonomy and this discussion. On the GVCs, the global value chains, in the process of globalization, integrating poorer nations in these value chains have been a real tool for integrating and for increasing the welfare of poorer nations. It has been a good thing. We can talk about globalization and the negative aspects, but the integration of poorer nations in these global value chains has been a win-win for everybody. The poorer world got in and learned and became richer. The richer world actually exploited some cost gains, right? Now, what the abrupt shock of the pandemic has made only too clear is that this dependence on very sort of multi, very long value chain actually creates uncertainty in the robustness. The resilience of these chains is actually put into doubt. Now, so the real, in my view, puzzle for the years to come is the following. How are we going to accept that there are good reasons why you might want to reduce the size of the global value chain on economic grounds, simply because you want to increase the resilience of it, but without necessarily becoming protectionist? Because that's how it was going to perceive the poorer world that will necessarily be taken out of these global value chains in order for this change to become more resilient, will perceive this as really antagonism and, you know, going back on globalization. This, I think, is the big tension here that is not an easy one to solve. Discussions of strategic autonomy only feed oil into this fire of protectionism and antagonism amongst global powers. I have been quite vocal about the fact that I believe that autonomy is really generating a narrative that is totally inappropriate for the types of problems that we have. The types of problems being global public goods, if you think about the pandemic, but also about climate, which is the real big problem to solve. We need to find cooperative solutions across the board. And we can't just have cooperative solutions on climate, but then antagonize the rest of the world or global value change or anything else. So, I mean, I think this is going to be a very difficult thing to resolve. And, you know, I'm delighted that we don't have Trumpers anymore in the narrative. but how much we've improved on global cooperation. And Guntram's analysis on the costs of vaccination is a really disappointing aspect of this, when it costs very little to solve a big problem, and even that not capable of doing. So I am a little bit concerned about our ability to manage global problems in quite the degree of urgency that we need to sort them with.
André, you want to react?
Just a couple of comments. One is to agree completely with Maria, and the other one, some slight disagreement. I completely agree where Maria concluded the cooperation, and I think the need for cooperation, global cooperation, in solving global problems. I think what Guntram had said that at the start, the global community did not do such a great job in terms of the distribution, the access to vaccination worldwide, and especially between poor and richer countries, and in particular for Africa, is something that may come and haunt us. When indeed, hopefully in not too long a future, we will be able to turn the page to the pandemic, at least to the difficulties associated with the pandemic. You know, it may become something permanent, but, you know, at the mild form. But global cooperation then for climate issue will be crucial. And unless indeed we come out of the pandemic in a better state of global cooperation, it will be, I think, very hard then to tackle the next and the bigger issue. And that's where I completely agree with Maria, which is the climate. And that has also huge distributional questions, both within our societies, but even more so, I think, between richer and poorer countries. So I think global cooperation is absolutely of the essence. If I want to disagree slightly with Maria, is about the resilience question. I think it's not fully clear to me whether reshoring is helping resilience. So we hear a lot of that discourse, right? We have been caught off guard because of the global value chains. And, you know, if we had produced some of those goods domestically, including semiconductors, there would not have been a shortage. I want to see the proof of that. And it may be the other way around, that after we reshore it and we think that we can rely on domestic production, there may still be shortages. And then we may miss the fact that we don't have the global value chain in order to ensure the resilience. But I think that question of resilience and global versus local production, I think, is not fully resolved. That's why I say I only partially disagree. I just want to put that as a question mark. That's all.
Yeah, I also wanted to just add three quick points. I think the first, just picking up on where André ended on the value chains, I think one tendency that we are observing now is not necessarily a shortening of value chains, but an increase of redundancies. So meaning you hold more stockages, you have more diversification. That comes with costs, but it doesn't necessarily mean that you reduce the length of your value chains. And I think that's probably an optimal response to the situation. The two quick points I wanted to add is, I think the European Union has to think, however, very carefully about critical infrastructure. There are areas where our infrastructure is vulnerable. It's vulnerable to cyber risks. It's vulnerable to disruptions, where the consequences go well beyond the specific sector that is affected. So be that our telecommunication networks or other areas. I mean, they're critical infrastructures where we are not resilient enough to geopolitical pressures, financial, etc. So we need to think about these critical infrastructures. And yes, that will have somewhat, I think, of a protectionist flavor that Maria, I think, rightly pointed out is a risk. But I think in some areas, this protectionist flavor might actually be necessary given the increased geopolitical tensions that we are seeing. The last quick point is really on what does the EU really need to do urgently? It's really to work together and stand together on geopolitical pressures. And there, let me just highlight the fact that Lithuania is now subject to economic repression from China because it has allowed to open a representation of Taiwan on its territory is not acceptable. And the fact that China targets specific trade and even targets companies that do trade, European companies, French, German companies that trade with Lithuania and then export into China, is something that the EU cannot accept. And, you know, we need to find a joint response to this and cannot accept that Lithuania is left alone on this. Because if Lithuania is left alone on it, our unified commercial policy is not working anymore. It breaks down our commercial policy. It breaks down our strengths. So I'm really quite worried that we don't come to clear and joint responses to these kind of economic coercion. And it's not enough to just point to instruments that will be developed in 23 or 24. We have to be able to react now. And I think we are not reacting enough.
So going really towards the end, we really want to make also a little Christmas present for all our listeners. We cannot give you physical books because we cannot hand to all of you under the Christmas tree a copy of a book which we would like to give to you as a present. But what we can do is to give you book suggestions and a reading list about books that for us have been marking particularly our reading list this year. So four books for you. Who would like to start? Maria, perhaps?
Okay, with pleasure. The book I'd like to recommend is one by Matt Ridley. The name of the book is How Innovation Works. I found the book very surprising. It has a lot of interesting anecdotes in there. I've learned from this book that innovation is not a revolution. Innovation is a process that lasts a long time. And that we need every stage in the innovation process is as valuable as the next. I recommend it because it's a lot of fun to read with a lot of very nice small anecdotes.
Thank you. André, your book?
The book I recommend that was published this year in a paperback format by Penguin is by an American anthropologist who is a professor of human evolutionary biology at Harvard, Joseph Henrich. The weirdest people in the world, the West became psychologically peculiar and particularly prosperous. And you should know that weird in the title, in capital letters, and stands for Western educated, industrialized, rich, and democratic. So it's a book that emphasizes culture as an important element in success and why the West has the particular culture, the weird, if you want, culture that it does have. So it's a book in the same vein, if you want, as Guns, Germs, and Steel by Jared Diamond or Sapiens by Harari books, sweeping over many issues and many, many centuries, sort of a bit history of the world. But with an economic, you can give it an economic reading. And I found it very, very fascinating to understand the global world where we live, not just Europe.
Guntram, your book?
I'm reading currently a book on cyber risks. It's called This Is How They Tell Me the World Ends by a New York Times journalist Nicole Perlroth. And I thought it's not just written really in a very exciting way. It's almost like a criminal investigation into cyber risks and, you know, how they can really affect all of us. And I think this is particularly relevant in these COVID times where, you know, we've all moved everything online, including our podcast recording today is completely online. And if you think about the risks associated with cyber attacks, I think that's really fascinating. And the consequences are really, really major. So I'm not yet through it. It's a very long book, but it reads very exciting, the beginning at least.
Thank you. And I also have a book to share. And funnily enough, it's also from an anthropologist. So in the same vibe of André, an anthropologist and an archaeologist. It's The Dawn of Everything, A New History of Humanity, which was just published in November, is by the late David Graeber, who died in September last year, and the archaeologist is David Wengrow. And what is interesting is that it gives a new narrative. Also, it comes from the same wave of Harari and so on, perhaps from a different perspective, but with this kind of very wide human history perspective, a new take on prehistory, and posits that humans lived in large, complex polities for millennia and developed numerous political structures, which we don't have any trace at the moment because of the fact that that there was no writing left or other manufacturing. So based on archaeological and anthropological evidence, it draws a different perspective on our prehistory. So all these books will be in the show notes. So you can, of course, as I said before, we cannot give it to you physically, but that's the most close to giving it to you as a present for the new year and the Christmas. So this brings us to the end of this episode. Thank you so much. I would like to thank also our listeners for following The Sound of Economics, and we hope that in 2022 you will be even more to join in. We will be keeping innovating our podcast as a space for discussion, exploration of new ideas, and to help you to understand better economic policy in order to improve it. Happy New Year, and until next time, bye-bye.